Welcome, Photon Warriors. Commence strategic maneuvers at audible command signal. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Jackalope Radio presents Movies Hate You. Movies Hate You, with your host, Rob Housechild.
And here we go. Here we are. Hey, whoa, we're live. That's right. The Movies Hate You show.
Welcome to the Movies Hate You Show 2014.
What happened to Todd? He totally bailed on that one.
Work on that.
Yeah, he's got other things on his mind. AKA the Wild Eye Radio Hour.
Uh-huh.
That's right, because we're sponsored by Wild Eye Releasing.
I've heard.
Tell us all about Wild Eye Releasing.
Wild Eye Releasing is your one-stop shopping center.
What a moron.
For cool movies.
Oh, God. It's more like a concept. It's kind of a label. So it's not really a one-stop. It's a label.
You
put things out there into the ether, and then sometimes they come back. Right?
I guess. Do they come back?
I don't know.
Has it come
you
back?
Better learn how to shield better if you want to stay on this show.
Because they always come back.
That's
chill
that's
or
the rule.
Chill? Because I thought I was supposed to chill.
No, you could chill out right now, but you need to shill the Wild Eye Dicker.
Take a shill pill.
Anyway, on the aforementioned Mr. H, Mr. House, shout out to you. To my left, forward, is my Asian valet and manservant, Mr. Lee Peterson.
Hello, hello.
I actually, you left me a gift, and it was Groucho on the Dick Cavett Show, and I watched it like 3 times.
Wasn't that great?
It's incredible.
Oh my God. And it's even
my
better.
My mother used to make a sandwich. You do Groucho better than me.
Well, he's pretty lucid at that point, but later. I think a few years later.
Even worse.
The stories are rambling and
Yeah, he actually sings a song in this one.
He does.
Yeah.
Lydia the Tech Lady.
That's right. One of my favorites. Todd Sheets on the boards. Todd Sheets, some of you may know as the micro budget indie filmmaker, Todd Sheets, of Zombie Bloodbath fame.
And the rest of you would know him from?
And the rest of you would know him from Nightwatch.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
The second most popular paranormal radio show in the world, second only to Coast to Coast. Isn't that correct?
I don't know about that, but I'm up there somewhere.
Who's going to know if we say that?
Yeah, I mean, right? Why don't you just go with it, dude? Like, who's going to fact check this show?
Okay, I'll go with it. Okay.
Anyway.
Nobody's going to fact check. This is the number one radio show in America, Todd. Nobody's going to fact check us.
Exactly.
Right?
We're like Teflon. We're like the Chris Christie of radio.
The number
untouchable.
One, number one radio
no,
channel.
No matter what we
North
do,
America.
Yeah. No matter what we do, our ratings will not go down.
No way.
No matter what we say or do on this show, no matter how many times you do Groucho, it's
no
not
matter.
Happening.
No matter.
So, like I was saying, Wild Eye Releasing being the sponsor and the label that I own. That's right. That's why it's the sponsor. Full disclosure, transparency. We have 2 films on cable VOD right now. Can you name them?
The first one, and then the other one. The one that's
I'm telling you, man.
One of them's a Christmas movie. Come on.
I know this.
I'm getting rid of this guy.
Cesar Nato's Deadly Xmas.
No, that was on cable in October.
Showgirls 2?
Showgirls 2 just started on cable this month. And
Murder University.
Richard Griffin's 80s slasher homage.
From,
check those out on your local provider. 30 million homes.
Nice.
You know, if only 5% of those people rented it, we could quit our day jobs.
I've never been to 30 million homes.
I've been in 30 million homes. Well, no, I mean, technically, the filmmakers that we represent have been in 30 million homes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If each house only spent a nickel on one of our movies,
then
if you knew the real percentages of VOD, I know a lot of people, they throw around that 30 million thing. It's like, oh my God, sometimes it's 50 million. But it's kind of like, you know, maybe like $1,000 per million, maybe, if you're lucky. That you actually bring home for indie films, for small films. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, if it's, you know, 12 Years a Slave or something, that's going to make lots of money. But if you're just an indie film out there struggling to fight,
like the Weinstein Company.
Anyway, I saw a tweet today. We are back on Twitter at Wild Eye DVD. So tweet us, retweet us, reply to us. Start a fight with us. Hashtag us. What else do people do on Twitter?
I don't know. What do they do?
Anyway,
they tweet.
Well, you can launch to that from our website, wildeyereleasing.com. And somebody tweeted today, it was actually us, Wildeye tweeted, I don't know what's worse, your dancing or your camel toe. That is a line from Showgirls 2.
Oh, I thought it was about me.
No.
Okay.
It's not. We're going to get to you soon. Okay. Maybe we'll put you on the Twitter account.
I could tweet. The only Twitter, what do you call a person? The only account
Twitter
that I follow is Beetlejuice from the Howard Stern Show. Perfect tweeter, because it's always just a random set of characters.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he's actually doing it himself.
Okay, kind of like when a zombie tries to write down something on a board,
sure,
and then holds it up across the parking lot to the people on the roof of the mall.
Similar to that.
It looks like that.
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, with the hashtag. That's
with the hashtag.
The Dawn of the Dead.
Dead remake. Yeah. Oh, man. We got a great show.
Quickly, before we get into our super.
This is a super special episode. Super special. We're live. Not giving you the number because we're not taking calls tonight, because we have a super special guest.
We do.
Seriously.
Before we announce that,
yeah,
can I just tell one quick anecdote last night?
Well, unless you're going to talk about the guy who shot somebody who was texting in the theater, because I wanted to talk about that.
No, that's yours.
We'll talk about that next time.
I met a Walking Dead actor last night.
Wow.
John Bernthal.
Wow.
Right? What do you think about that?
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We know we had a Walking Dead actor on the show.
We did.
And in fact, I was just watching Dallas Buyers Club the other day. And
Dallas is
in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah.
And he's good. He plays Matthew McConaughey's lawyer.
It looks like the part was maybe cut down.
Yeah.
Because none of the scenes really go very far with him.
Yeah.
It looked like maybe he was more an integral part.
And he didn't die and become a zombie at the end.
Spoiler.
Yeah.
That's a spoiler, isn't it?
Is it? If you've missed season 2 or 3?
No, I mean, spoiler that he doesn't die in the movie.
He doesn't die.
He doesn't become a zombie.
But Matthew McConaughey does.
Does he become a zombie? No.
Define zombie.
Hmm.
And we're still talking about him and making movies about him, so theoretically he's still alive.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Mm-hmm. He's probably
cancer. I mean, the character McConaughey's playing, McConaughey's alive.
He is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm talking about the man he plays in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know the Jared Leto part was all made up for the movie. There was no tranny friend.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't want to look behind the curtain.
Let me tell you, Jared Leto makes a very ugly woman. Did I mention that?
You think so? I thought he was pretty.
Really? Yeah. Oh, God.
Huh.
No, not at all.
I thought he had good features.
No.
Anyway.
No, but I think that's something to deal with on a...
Another day.
You should deal with that.
But anyway, John Bernthal was nice. I just got an autograph from him.
You did?
Got a picture signed.
Where did you get a picture?
No, I went to the internet.
Wait, no, I don't. Because you work in Manhattan, mm-hmm. I thought you kind of like you bumped into him on the street.
I just happened to have a portfolio in my bag. And,
it wouldn't surprise me.
He was on the Jimmy Fallon show last night.
Oh,
so
okay.
I go to this site that tells you like weeks in advance who's booked for shows, and I saw he was going to be on. I was like, maybe I'll try to get out early, get out of work early, go up there, get an autograph. Mm. If it happens, it happens. Yeah, it was easy. He came out and signed for everybody. Probably half a dozen of us.
Mm.
Deadheads.
Deadheads, is that what they call them?
That's what they're calling them now.
Huh. Todd, did you get that number I texted over to you?
I did.
Okay, just making sure before we go into that. I think that's cool, man.
That's all, you know.
So now do you have Rooker?
I don't have Rooker. I met him years ago before Walking Dead.
Yeah.
When he was at some convention.
It's funny, if you had the foresight, you could have had him sign something Walking Dead related when you met him all those years ago, and then you would have a signed Walking Dead something.
One of a kind.
Isn't that funny?
Thing, yeah.
Do you ever think of that?
Never.
How don't you ever think of that?
I still don't think of that.
You should do that. You should go to these things and say, because I know you're going to be in the third Star Wars film 10 years from now, can you sign this?
Just in case.
Just in case. Yeah. A just in case signature. I like that.
I think so. What some people do is they bring index cards when they're trying to get autographs. Right. Just a blank index card. And that way,
they'll frame it.
They'll mat it with a picture of their favorite movie or whatever.
Whichever. Yeah, right. Right. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah. Yeah,
I prefer to get an item signed on the item. I don't know.
Really?
Me. I don't know.
Yeah. What did you get signed?
I went to the internet and found a publicity still from Walking Dead.
Nice.
Where he's got his gun up in the air.
Nice.
This is really cool. Dark clouds in the sky. Very cool. I printed it out. It worked. Big deal.
Nice.
Yeah. Free.
Free.
100% free. Didn't have to stand in line. Didn't have to spend $60 at a convention.
Yeah, that's the way it should be.
Free.
Now, unfortunately, not everyone who collects autographs lives in the city where, in LA or New York, where they can go stalk the stage doors and get these autographs.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God. It'd be a madhouse. Imagine the crowd.
Yeah. But maybe that's why the autograph is so valuable when they do go to a show in the Midwest or somewhere else.
Yeah. I'm not begrudging anybody who does. I'm just saying, hey, great. You know, I did it for free.
Don't put down the people that listen to this show who might attend conventions.
Yeah. I've attended a few in the past myself, but got pretty jaded.
Yeah, very quickly, because you had to pay all that money.
You can't. I mean,
now it's free.
You have to drop $300 if you go in. I mean, can you imagine
if
you went to one of these conventions where there's half a dozen Walking Dead people, and let's say that's all you were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Confine yourself just to the Walking Dead people.
Yeah.
You're talking at least $25 each.
Yeah.
So right, that's $1.50 right there. Maybe they'll charge you to get a Polaroid taken, or I mean, a photo taken with them. You might have dropped $200 just for one lousy picture.
Are you going to put your Dallas Roberts next to your Shane?
Already done.
Even though they never met in the series.
Already done, and maybe somebody from season 4 will be my next conquest. You know, then I'll have. Kind of a chronological timeline of Walking.
You should only get signatures of people who die. That's perfect. Mm. You get Dallas Roberts, you get Shane, who only lasts one. Well, Shane lasted two, right? So people that only last a couple seasons or one season.
Yeah. Yeah.
Herschel's next for you.
Herschel. Have to get Herschel.
Oh, I just gave away a spoiler.
Dope! In case you are living under a rock.
Well, not everybody likes The Walking Dead or watches it when it comes on. They watch it on DVD. They watch it on VOD. They might watch it on Netflix.
Yeah.
I mean, I just watched Breaking Bad in the last year or so, even though it's been on the air for years.
I think, I observe the 24-hour rule. I don't talk about spoilers with anybody for 24 hours. You figure, if you're that big of a fan, you're going to find a way.
That's going to bother
everybody's
you,
got
right.
a cell phone or
right.
whatever. There's right. a million ways to watch the movie. There's the show. If you haven't watched it in 24 hours, then beware.
Okay.
Then it's on you
okay.
to avoid the spoilers.
All right. Well, so, speaking of spoilers, I don't want to spoil your Walking Dead fanfare here, but we do have a special guest coming on.
Yeah, absolutely.
That you were kind enough to procure for the Movies Hate You show.
Well, it is my extreme pleasure. The movie is The Act of Killing. We talked about this during the summer, I think, when it
we
first
did.
Came out. We did a,
we had both
almost
seen
a
it.
Show.
Yeah.
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 On it. We're both big fans. It's an extraordinary movie. It's a documentary. It's now available on a special edition Blu-ray/DVD with all kinds of bonus. I think there's a book and stuff in it. That's also on VOD. So if you haven't seen it in your in the select cities that's played theatrically, now's your chance to see it. I recommend it highly to everyone.
Amazing, amazing documentary. Disturbing, yet fascinating. Can't take your eyes off this film. You can easily go to just Google The Act of Killing. It's a 2012 film. Trailers all over the place. You have to see this film. Seriously. And I know most of our listeners, for the most part, I think are kind of general movie fans, but we do have a lot of horror and cult movie fans. This is a horror movie. This is a horror movie. It really is. It's horror.
It is.
It's disturbing.
It is.
It's more disturbing than anything I've ever seen come out of a studio in the last couple of years.
And disturbing, and yet not graphically. Not graphic.
No. The content, the subject matter, the execution or the unfolding, I should say, the unfolding of this film. Once you realize that almost you're part of it, that you're witnessing this and it's actually happening, it's like it's unlike any other feeling that you'll get. You almost feel like you shouldn't be watching this. It has an odd like, is this real? Am I really watching this? If it's real, I'm really don't know if I'm disturbed about it, or I should be, shouldn't I? I guess, but it's so engaging, and it's like almost these characters are almost likable.
Exactly, it brings up so many different emotions, conflicting emotions. Instead of just yapping about it, maybe we should bring Josh on.
We should bring
right now
one of the filmmakers, because there's multiple filmmakers responsible for the film.
There are two. We can ask Josh about
that. We'll ask Josh, but we'll let Josh. You want to explain the film before we bring Josh
on?
Well,
maybe while Todd's dialing up, maybe we can.
Todd, dial up Josh Oppenheimer, one of the directors of The Act of Killing.
I'll give the 50-cent synopsis. Basically,
which was also Werner Herzog and Earl Morris jumped on as executive producers after they had seen an early cut of the film. I mean, that's how powerful this is. Two of the best documentarians in the world just were like, yes, you know, it's Herzog in its own way.
And they don't just loan their names to the movies.
No, forget it.
It's not Wes Craven Presents.
No.
Hello?
Hey, Josh. It's Lee. How are you?
Yeah. Hi, Lee.
Hey. Thanks for joining us. Sitting beside me, my compatriot, Rob Housechild.
How are you, Josh? Thank you so much for coming on.
And way over.
You're so welcome. It's my pleasure. You're so welcome. It's my pleasure. Can you hear me clearly?
Yeah. There's a little bit of a sound in the background.
There's some noise happening in the background. Sounds like a commotion.
I'm trying to go to a quiet spot.
Oh, that's great.
It's actually getting better as you.
Perfect. Thanks for joining us, and congratulations on all the praise your film has been getting since it was released, I guess, in the summer, which is when I saw it. You are on the film is on the short list for the Academy Award nominations, which are two nights from now.
Yep.
So congratulations and good luck on that.
Well, you're nominated for
two BAFTA awards, which is also a pretty big deal. Your head must be spinning. Are you tired of talking about the movie after all this time?
Not with you, Lee, but no. It becomes of course it's repetitive, but at the same time it's iteration with difference. Every time I talk about it, almost I discover something new about the film or about the audience's reaction. So it's been a pleasure overall.
Yeah, well, we were just sort of talking about it before we brought you on, and there's so much going on in the movie. So many it brings up so many emotions, conflicting emotions. I don't think that you necessarily spell out the intention, but to me, it opens up the whole question of what is good, what is evil. Are people good? Are they evil? Are the people evil, or are the acts evil? And that's the kind of thing that I've been wrestling with ever since I saw the movie. I mean, was that your intention? Is that one of your intentions?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, I think that normally when we tell stories, we divide the world. Normally, I should say, when we tell stories, almost all of them are based on a single, simplistic, and dishonest moral paradigm where we divide the world into good guys and bad guys. And a slightly more complicated riff on that is to divide ourselves internally into good parts and bad parts. I think in either manifestation, the more simple one and the more complex one, we are somehow lying to ourselves. At the end of the day, I think somehow I call this kind of moral, dishonest moral paradigm the Star Wars morality. I think every time we tell a story based on it, we're lying to ourselves and we're insidiously reinforcing it. I think that the message, I think in The Act of Killing, we ask the viewer to identify, even for a fleeting moment, even in a single scene, with a man who's killed hundreds, thousands, of people. And in that moment, of course, the facade that the world is divided into good guys and bad guys comes crumbling down, because we recognize that, and we recognize as viewers somehow that we're all much closer to perpetrators than we like to believe. And I think that one of the most disturbing things that the film witnesses, and one of the most perhaps counterintuitive things that it witnesses, and it witnesses it inside of Anwar Kongo as an individual, and it witnesses this at the level of the whole society, is that so much of our evil stems not from actions that are motivated by evil intention, but by our very morality, which we as humans all share at some level.
Now,
I can sort of unpack that for you if it's unclear, but if it...
No, it's perfectly clear. Anwar Kongo, you mentioned, he's, to me, the most compelling character in this whole piece. I think because his humanity is a little closer to the surface, and the arc of the film, the arc of his character, we sort of... We're not seeing it through his eyes, but I think that if we're able to bring compassion to any of these people... He's where we place it, because he seems like a regular person. If you forget, and it's easy to forget what he actually did, if you just see him interacting with his grandchildren, for instance, he's just a normal person.
Well, of course, Anwar is just a normal person, and that's the horrific truth of the movie, that normal people, insofar as genocide happens, its perpetrators are normal people. And being normal people, they know what they've done is wrong, they know what they're doing is wrong. And as Adi, Anwar's best friend from his death squad, or Anwar's the sole surviving member of Anwar's death squad, and one of his best friends since he was a young man, says so concisely in the film, he says, killing is the worst thing you can do. But if you can get away with it, and if you're paid well enough to do it, go ahead and do it. But then you must make up an excuse and cling to justifying what you've done, and cling to it for the rest of your life. And that is just, if you think about what Adi's saying there, he's saying you have to lie to yourself. And when a regime, a government, a group of perpetrators kill hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people, get away with it, they then collectively write a story, a victor's history, to justify what they've done. And that is the lie to which the perpetrators have to cling. One of the exciting things now that's happening in the United States with the film is that the director's cut has just been made available on Blu-ray, on iTunes, and on DVD. And there you see in some detail the propaganda that the government of Indonesia has made up justifying the killing in the form of a 4.5-hour propaganda, very violent propaganda film that to which every young Indonesian school child has had to watch from kindergarten onward every year. And we see that in clinging to the lie of this propaganda, when perpetrators cling to the lie of the propaganda justifying their actions, when a whole regime does indeed, it inevitably leads to this downward spiral of further evil and corruption that culminates ultimately in a total moral vacuum. Because after getting away with it, after justifying it, after lying about what they've done, the perpetrators now have to blame their victims, because of course the propaganda says it was their fault, they had it coming. They have to dehumanize the victims, because it's much easier for the perpetrators to live with themselves if their victims are not fully human in the perpetrator's eyes. And of course, they have to kill again. Because if the government of Indonesia now tells Anwar, kill this other group of people for the same reason as you killed the first group, if Anwar refuses the second time, it's equivalent to somehow admitting it was wrong the first time. And that's exactly what Anwar's never been forced to do, and what he and his fellow perpetrators are desperate to avoid. And so if you think of that, What actually is motivating this downward spiral, that the further evil, is not the fact that these men are monsters and just will commit evil because they have this kind of wanton demonic side to them, but on the contrary, because being human, they know what they've done is wrong and are desperately clinging to the lie justifying it so they don't have to face the true moral meaning of what they've done, the true horror of what they've done, which is, of course, exactly what the film leads Anwar to face.
Right. Now, in case anybody doesn't know exactly what we're talking about here, this was in 1965, there was an uprising or a coup in Indonesia, and the communists were in power, and they were basically slaughtered by the other. What did they call themselves?
Actually, the communist league were not in power. There was a non-aligned, broad-based leftist anti-colonial government, is a left-wing government, but it was overthrown by the military, and everybody in the society who was opposed to the new military regime was then accused of being a communist and targeted for execution or for decades of imprisonment and torture.
Ah, okay.
And the people who've done this have been in power ever since, and consequently have never been forced to admit what they've done is wrong. So unlike aging Nazis who, when you hear from them, deny what they've done or apologize for it, these men do neither. They boast, and it turns out the boasting is in part defensive, a desperate attempt to convince themselves that what they've done is right and to impose that view on the rest of their society.
I mean, it sounds, you know, similar to what any empire, any country does in the wake of war. We do this. We, you know, I assume because they're still in power, that's why they do this. Had they been overthrown, had these people been made accountable, you might see something like you see with the Nazis, who, you know, were disbanded and who have no choice but to face what they've done or to just deny it and you know, live in obscurity that way. But in this, they're still thriving in this political culture that was created back then because of these killings. But to me, what I loved, one of the aspects I really loved about the film is that it made me think about our own country and what have we done. And then we have war heroes who we worship, who have slaughtered and done things. Now, you know, for many different reasons, not the same reasons. You know, it's not just an outright political upheaval, but it makes you think about war and how we kind of worship our warriors in a sense.
Yeah, I think that it's tempting to see the act of killing as a kind of portrait of what happens when the moral universe is turned totally on its head, and to see it as some kind of surreal exception to the rule, to see it as a kind of dark allegory for the depths of human depravity. I think that's really not to... I'm happy to say that I think most viewers around the world have seen the film and risen to its bigger challenge, which is to see the film not just as a mirror held up to Indonesian society, but as a mirror held up to all of us, in the sense that I think that perpetrators kill because they and commit acts of violence because it is effective. So it's tempting to say this is the exception to the rule. Normally, like the Nazis, perpetrators get their comeuppance and are removed from power. I think perpetrators perpetrate mass violence because it's effective, because they win. And it's the Nazis who are the exception to the rule. It's the Hutu extremists in Rwanda who were overthrown. That's the exception to the rule. Normally, perpetrators win and remain in power. And if anything, the act of the boasting of the perpetrators in Indonesia is the allegory for the rule. It's the metaphor for the rule. You know, it's also worth pointing out that not only did the United States support the genocide in Indonesia with money, with weapons, with training, and with lists of thousands of Indonesian writers, intellectuals, trade union leaders whom the U.S. government wanted dead, the U.S. also provided, the U.S. also depends, or we, I think, in the U.S., depend for our lifestyle on the whole global South, or much of the global South, having been engineered to resemble the Indonesia of the act of killing through our foreign policy, so that everything we buy, almost everything we buy, is manufactured in places like Indonesia of the act of killing, places where there's been mass political violence, where perpetrators have won, where in their victories they've built regimes of fear that keep everybody who makes everything we buy, that is the workers who make everything we buy, too afraid to effectively get the human cost of what we buy, the real cost of what we buy, included in the low price tag that we pay for it. So in that sense, Indonesia in the act of killing is not just this distant reality, it is the underbelly of our everyday reality. I think almost all of the listeners to this program will already know that, in fact, even if we find it easier not to look at that normally.
No, I think the casual movie fan watching this might, you know, everyone's so used to black and white villains and good guys in film. So when you see this, you know, you're thinking like, oh, I'm waiting, you know, oh my God, you hear about the movie and you're like, these villains, these you know, despicable men, we're going to see this movie on them. And you start watching it and it's like they're almost comical and likable, and you're like, it starts really messing with your head.
They are likable. I mean, they're not just almost likable, they're likable. And that says something about...
It's hard for me to admit it and say, yes, they're likable, because I don't want condemnation coming down on me saying, well, you thought those guys were likable, you're a sociopath. See, I'm already editing myself when I'm saying that to you.
Well, it's interesting. I think that the film provokes a kind of discomfort in people as we're forced... I mean, as the film... The film invites viewers to become close to Anwar through my closeness to Anwar. That's not to say I made this film for him. On the contrary, I made this film for and in collaboration and in constant dialogue with the survivors and the human rights community in Indonesia, and with whom I started this journey as a way of exposing a whole regime of impunity that was a present-day regime of impunity that's built on unresolved past trauma. But... I did become close to Anwar through making the film, and viewers become close to him through my relationship to him. And I think that's a very uncomfortable position for some viewers to be in. The film indeed has been crafted as a kind of tightrope walk between balancing repulsion on the one hand for the crimes against humanity in which this man is involved, is complicit, and on the other hand, our empathy or even sympathy for a man who is wrestling with his own past and haunted by the horror of what he's done. And so, of course, there's a discomfort because it is a balancing act all the way through the film.
Were there ever times when you found yourself forgetting exactly what he actually did? I mean, he's so charming, I guess, that and I'm sure you spent many an hour with him. Were there times when you just simply forgot for a minute?
I think not for a second did I forget why we were doing this or what he did. But I think there's something more insidious that happens, and it's a little more difficult to describe. I think one of the ironies of the film is that all the talking about what they did, all the boasting about what he did, all the reenacting of what he did, all the representing of what he did, actually, as much as it describes what he did, it also somehow serves to erase it, because the unimaginable realness of it, which is escapes every representation, every time it's portrayed, the actual horror of what happened moves just beyond the grasp of the representation. And that, of course, is what erupts with a vengeance, with a real force at the end of the film, when Anwar finally returns after 5 years of filming with me to the rooftop where we began the journey together. That moment was a moment where while I never forgot the content of what he did, I remember thinking to myself, as someone who cared about him, I wanted to put my arm on him and say, it's going to be okay. And I realized in that moment, oh no, this is of course what it looks like when it's not ever going to be okay again.
Mm. Right. That's the scene you're talking about is cathartic, I think, to the audience, because we, without getting into details, we see kind of how it's all been boiling up in him, and he's confronted with it in a physical way. What are you still in touch with Anwar?
Anwar and I are in touch every month or so. When Anwar saw the film, he was moved by it. He said he cried a lot. He was silent for a long time. He then said, this film shows what it is like to be me. Then he silent again for a long time and said, Josh, I'm relieved to finally have been able
to show what these things mean, as opposed to merely what I've done. Of course, the you know, it's a painful relationship. I wouldn't call it a friendship. I think he and I were both working out much bigger projects through the relationship, through that relationship, than the relationship itself. And in that sense, it can never be a friendship. Exactly. I was trying to expose a whole regime of impunity on behalf of survivors in the human rights community, while Anwar was trying to deal with his a lifetime of pain. But I think we care a great deal for each other, and we will stay in touch, even if it's painful to do so, because we've been through such an intense experience together.
Right.
Just taking a break. You're listening to the Movies Hate You show. With us is Josh Oppenheimer, one of the directors of The Act of Killing. The film, Josh, has it's really about it's about everything we've been discussing, but also it's about movies and movie making in a very one of the most interesting ways I've ever seen, where you have your characters reenact some of these horrific things that they've done to other humans, but through genre. Through the genres that they loved, because they started out as kind of petty gangsters. What were they called? Movie house gangsters? What was the name?
Movie theater gangsters. That's right.
Movie theater gangsters with the tickets. And it's funny how we start with that, and then we go into the reenactments. They're reenacting these. Sometimes incompletely, or trying to reenact these things they've done through these different genres. I think that somehow it softens the blow for us a little bit as you know, movie lovers. But even it's a harsher sting for me at the end, because I'm like, oh well, they're, you know, this is kind of comical, this is funny, but they're reenacting things they actually went through, and they describe me like, no, I would actually stand behind him like this and cut it this way. And they're talking about it as if they're talking about, you know, changing the water in a bowl or something. It's nothing.
Or they're talking about it as one talks about it when one directs a movie. I don't think those two things are contradictory. That's what directing a movie can be like.
Do you think that it's a full circle thing, where their love for, like, these are just, you know, movie lovers who got caught up in this other thing, but that love of film never left them? And
well, that's true.
Being able to act this out in the film was almost this kind of, it was more of a Hollywood kind of fantasy dream for them, and not necessarily, oh, okay, you want me to reenact the killings, but can I wear this? Can we do it as a Western? Can we do it? It almost seemed like, you know, here's a real payoff for them, something they would never have been able to do, but might have fantasized about and been sidetracked by all this political horror that they were involved in.
Well, I think it started off that way, the project, in a way. It could have been for Anwar. It was a chance to realize a fantasy of being in a film, but I think very quickly it became a way that Anwar was being listened to, and a way for him to deal finally with some very, very real pain. I think cinema is the great... The movie does ask some big questions about cinema. We watch... What are we doing when we watch movies? What are we doing when we watch violence in movies? Film is we're used to seeing beautifully, aesthetically rendered images of suffering and perfectly framed images of death and tragedy in cinema. And the real world reference is absent. That's part of our the imaginative contract we have with the screen, that, okay, this is fake. And I think that fundamentally affects how we project our fantasies onto the images we see on the screen. And I think when we recognize somehow in The Act of Killing that every frame is haunted by the real, by the unspeakable horror that defies representation, that's beyond anything that could be on the screen, but that it's the real people with real horror, sometimes the reenactments trigger the kind of bubbling up or catalyze the explosion into the present of real trauma from the past, And we see also in the political vignettes in the film how that trauma is keeping the whole society afraid, paralyzed by fear, and how that fear, because everyone's afraid of the politicians and the business leaders, how that enables them to, the leaders of modern Indonesia, to get away with incredible corruption. When we feel the force of the real haunting every frame of the fiction, I think it's a very queasy, uncomfortable moment where we ask ourselves, what are we doing when we watch film? The film doesn't pose answers to those questions, it just raises them. But one of the things that I think the film raises there is what is really something about storytelling. I mean, cinema is maybe the great storytelling medium of modernity. And this is a film about the effect of the stories that we tell ourselves, especially the lies that we tell ourselves, to just the excuses we tell ourselves to justify our actions, and the consequence of denial. And insofar as cinema, particularly Hollywood cinema over the course of its development, served as a great vehicle of escaping from the problems of life, great vehicle for not looking at who we are, the film is a kind of warning to us about what happens when we don't look at our problems. Just broadly, if we want to, we as a species face some pretty tremendous challenges, on which the whole challenges which we better confront if we want to survive as a species. So we'd better learn to look at our most painful truths. And cinema's place in that is not necessarily something that requires some kind of reinvention. I think that in the film, though, it's also worth saying that if Anwar's filmmaking process begins as a way for him to run away from his pain, somehow it also becomes the vehicle or the prism through which finally he's able to look at the problem, at the most painful aspects of who he is, just as the film as a finished work has led Indonesia to look at the most painful aspects, at its most painful truths, at the most pain. It's opened a space for Indonesians to confront the most painful aspects of who they are.
What's been the reaction from the Indonesian government to the film?
The government has been, by and large, pretty quiet on the film, but they've tried to ignore it. They have not banned it, nor have they officially given their approval for the film being commercially released. But that said, the film has, the most wonderful thing about releasing this film has been the impact in Indonesia. It has led the Indonesian media to start reporting on what happened in 1965 in depth, talking about the genocide as a genocide as opposed to a glorious chapter in Indonesia's past. Talking about it as a crime against humanity, and talking about it's led the media, mainstream media in Indonesia, to finally talk about the connection between present-day corruption and thuggery and fear on the one hand, and impunity for crimes against humanity on the other. So it's led to a sea change in how the media talks about itself. If the film can't be distributed commercially because the government has not, because of the fear that the government would ban the film, but the film has been screened thousands of times in hundreds of Indonesian cities and is available for free download for anybody in Indonesia. It's perhaps the most talked about and even loved work of culture in the history of modern independent Indonesia, and it's come to the country like the child in the emperor's new clothes, opening this space for Indonesians to finally talk about their most serious problems for the first time and without fear.
And we should say again that The Act of Killing is available on iTunes and also a new special edition Blu-ray DVD. It's a longer cut, is that right?
In fact, there's the director's cut of the film is available on both iTunes, Blu-ray, and DVD. The shorter theatrical cut is also there, but the director's cut is the main international festival version of the film. It's the version that many viewers who've experienced the film around the world will have seen in their theaters, and it's now arrived in the United States. The longer cut, the director's cut, has a commentary as well, a commentary track from myself and Werner Herzog, which provides a lot of context and sort to the individual themes in the film and to some of the issues the film raises.
Right. Now, how speaking of Herzog, how did Herzog and Errol Morris get involved? They lent their names to the movie, at least as a present.
Executive
producer.
But that was after they had seen a cut, right?
Yeah, that's right. Errol saw roughly edited scenes in late 2010, just a few of them, and said this is something he wanted to support in whatever way he could, and he was very supportive, and eventually we brought, he signed on as an executive producer to help support the movie. Werner saw the director's cut of the film, or almost a final cut of the director's cut, and said, "What are you doing next?" I said, "We're cutting it down so it reaches a wider audience in American theaters." And he said, "That's a crime. You must not cut this film down." We said, "We have to." To which he said, "You must be blind at this point. And so if you want me to look at any rough cuts of your shorter version, I'm very happy to do so." I should say, when I say that we said we have to do it, because in fact we were obliged to provide a 90-minute version to broadcasters. But we chose to make the shorter theatrical version, the two-hour version, because we knew that in its director's cut at 2 hours and 40 minutes, it was going to have a hard time being released beyond just a few cinemas in the most major cities in the United States. So we felt it's really important for as much of this experience as possible to reach as wide an audience in the United States as possible. So we made that shorter version.
To me, it's a very Herzogian film. I can see his attraction to it, and there's something. It's about the film within a film, almost the absurdity of it. It reminds me a lot of Herzog's work. That said, I'm not saying it stands on its own. I'm not saying it is a Herzog film, but I'm not surprised at all that he immediately got involved and lent his name to the film.
Yeah, I think that's, thank you. I think the film creates its own nightmarish allegorical universe, and that's something that I think Werner does in both his fiction films and his documentary films. Some of the lesser seen ones, like Even Dwarf Started Small and Strozek and the Bad Lieutenant, New Orleans Port of Call, as much as the more obvious ones.
I agree with that. We're winding down.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. It was a great pleasure.
You know, thank you so much, Joshua. The Act of Killing, available iTunes. Also on the theatrical cuts available on Amazon, as is the Blu-ray and DVD. Please watch this film and keep an eye on it for Oscar season, if that's your thing, because the film is on the short list for Best Documentary.
Well deserved.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Joshua. Real pleasure to have you, and best of luck and continued success.
Thanks.
We are going to follow the film in the coming weeks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So, should we wrap up?
Yeah, I think we're at the end, Todd, right? What do we got? I'm showing 4 or 5 minutes here. Less than 5 minutes.
We are rocking.
Who's counting, though?
I don't know. We're rocking. I don't know what exactly that...
Yes, you do! Yes, you know!
Question. I thought that was great, man.
That was fantastic.
Oh, man, that was deep.
I have so many questions about this
movie. It's just one of those movies that you can just keep going on, and if you're a film buff, and we all are, right, and you wouldn't be listening to this if you weren't, you're watching this, and it's just like, I wanted to ask him if those guys knew that they were reenacting these crimes, or they thought they were actually being filmed for... It almost seemed like at one point, like they were being tricked into recreating what they were doing for this quote-unquote film that was going to come out, but the documentary was actually the film. See what I mean?
Right, right.
So it almost at first, but I think by the end, it just kind of... I lost that concept, but I thought, oh, this is almost like you're tricking... It's like... It would be like tricking Mengele into like recreating his experiments in like a phony... horror movie lab or something. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's the comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that sounds absurd. And people be like, "Oh, why would you do that? That you would immediately get banned forever." But this is what this film is.
Yeah, I don't think. I mean, I won't obviously speak for Josh, but I don't think that was the intention. I think that became a method to get them to open up.
Yeah.
And because they have that distance, again, when they're staging something, it's pretend, even though it was real.
But it's so bizarre. It's almost like, you know, hey man, I'm just making this up. You got somebody who's got a conviction for running somebody over when they were drunk driving. And then you say, hey, let's recreate it. You'd be like, that's just disrespectful. Mm-hmm. So, like, these people just have no line of distinction between life and death.
Or it's just the cognitive dissonance, I guess. The distancing themselves. O.J. Simpson wrote a book after the murders called If I Did It.
If I Did It.
And right. He did an audio version of it, which I have on tape somewhere, where I think in order for him to record, he described... He's trying to prove that he didn't do it, because if he had, this is how he would have done it.
He would have done it much differently.
And he describes in detail how he would go about doing it. And I think that's the cognitive dissonance, is that...
That was probably cathartic for him.
Right.
It was a parallel confession.
Exactly.
In a sense.
Exactly.
Right.
He can confess without confessing.
And it was in his mind read it as, you've got it off your chest. You can move on. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see Oppenheimer or another filmmaker go in and try to do that with OJ. Go in there and do a because this is therapeutic for the people involved. It's not just, hey, it's therapeutic for all of us if we watch this film. It's therapeutic for the Indonesian people. It's therapeutic for those killers. It's almost a form, more than prison would ever do for them, to have them kind of live in this nightmare of recreating their crime and having to face it in that sense, helping them face it in real life instead of putting them in a cell for 50 years.
Mm. And I've heard the criticism too that it's a propaganda piece for the killers because it humanizes them. Well, I think it's BS.
But that's
a way of looking at it. And people, some people are turned off because he doesn't condemn them.
Yeah, right. I could see it looked at as you're elevating the, it's kind of like serial killer culture where we kind of, you know, there are these films about serial killers where it's really not, it's just kind of showing what they've done as almost like a celebration of what they've done instead of, you know, a murder mystery or something. Yeah.
Right. And it never assuages them of the guilt. I mean, we never see them as, we see them as human, but not, we still know what they did. They're still, quote unquote, monstrous.
Right.
The actions were monstrous.
Right. But they know what they did, and they've lived for so long. This is actually a step in the positive direction to get them to realize what they did, because they're out there living free, having families, and
they're heroes.
Yeah. They're looked at as heroes. But see, you know what I was trying to say is, this reminds me of, like, if you watch a Western, you know, a particular Western that has, like, you know, cowboys killing Indians, or you have some kind of, like, it's almost like if you went and had those cowboys recreate this kind of genocide of the Native American. You know, it's but we do that. We Western heroes, and, you know, okay, we got movies and we got statues and everything. You know, we make these guys into our superheroes in a sense. You know, these old West. What did these guys do? Like, you know, what did they do? Some of these cowboys were, you know, under the employ of the government doing this kind of, you know, genocide on the Native Americans. But they're worshipped in this culture. It's looked on as American icons. So why is that different than what Oppenheimer's done by showing these guys, kind of pulling them out of the shadows in a sense, and showing what they've done?
Absolutely.
You know? It's a backdoor. It's a roundabout way of kind of, you know, pointing a finger at them. And they were almost, you know, the architects of their own doom in that sense, which is brilliant.
Indeed.
How they've got these guys involved, kind of like, yeah, come on, let's recreate these crimes, you know, like, let's do it as a musical, let's do it as a war movie. Okay, fine, yeah, let me show you what we did. We cut the heads off this way, we did this, we did that. Boom, you got your confession right on tape there.
It would also be a lot more difficult for the audience to watch if it was a straightforward,
well, that's the thing.
Show me what you did, and there wasn't that distancing.
What I wanted to say to Josh is that had he done this just as a straight documentary, you know, would have lived in obscurity forever. With every other documentary, you know, about some kind of, you know,
war-related political thing in another country. It wouldn't be getting the... It's the craftsmanship. It's so brilliant.
Really is.
I look forward to his next work.
Absolutely. And the only other thing I want to add is that it's seeing this has changed the way I look at people, not necessarily for the good, but it's... You can... Seeing these people and knowing what they did and then seeing how charming they can be makes you think any person that you meet...
Mm-hmm.
They might seem like lovely people, but you don't know what they did 20 years ago.
You don't know what they did in their youth.
You have no way of knowing.
The person you're married to, the person you're dating, the people in your family. You don't know.
You just have to trust.
Well, you trust, but it's a lot easier if you understand that we all live in a gray area. We all live in a gray blob of morality. We really do. And like these guys, it just so happened there were these petty movie ticket gangsters. And they got pulled into this political thing, and they went with it because that's how they survived, and that's what they did, and that's how they kept their butts clean and from their heads not getting chopped off. So that morality could have, had the political climate went somewhere else, they wouldn't have killed hundreds of people in their lives. They could have just lived out their lives and, been petty con men, or maybe not, or maybe just got families and moved away from all that. You don't know. But the morality was there, and it just shifted. It's kind of like when people talk about Breaking Bad. Was Walt always bad or did he break bad? Mm-hmm. That's always the question. Mm-hmm. And it was always there. It was always there. Just the right chemistry came around and it just snapped.
And a bigger question, which who knows the answer to, is can you come back from that? Can Anwar come back from what he did and become
a... I don't think so.
Hey, thanks for having us. So you've been listening to the Movies Hate You show, sponsored by...
Wild Eye Releasing.
Wild Eye Releasing.
That's right. .com. You can email us at movieshateyou@gmail.com. Find us on iTunes. Find us in the archives.
Lovely. Well, this has been the Movies Hate You show. Thanks to Skype for all their wonderful technical problems. Microsoft can eat our ass.
My eye, girl, I never loved one like you.
Man, oh man, you're my best friend. I scream it too. There ain't nothing that I need.
Well, hot and heavy, pumpkin pie, chocolate candy, Jesus Christ. Ain't nothing please me more than you.
Let me come home. Home is wherever I'm with you. Oh.
fell out of my window.
I saw a three-year-old jumping out of